This is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. I'm your MC, Alan Minsky. On today's show, we'll hear from Eric Mann of Los Angeles' Labor Community Strategy Center about strategies for effective organizing. Then we'll talk to Isabel Garcia, a lawyer who works with the Coalition for Human Rights in Tucson, Arizona, representing immigrant workers in that embattled state. Then we'll be joined by Francis Fox Piven, a sociologist and political scientist and advocate for the unemployed in the United States. Then we'll be joined by Patricia Torres, a graduate student in urban planning at UCLA who was involved in the student movements there over the past couple of years and also is an advocate for immigrant rights and works with Insight, Women of Color Against Violence. And finally, we'll hear from Derek Jensen, one of the most trenchant and radical voices in the contemporary environmental movement. All that on today's installment of Building a Powerful Left in the United States. Today's show is taking place on a historic day. The streets of Cairo are packed, and decades of autocratic reign in Egypt look like they may be coming to an end due to popular mobilization, something that seemed unthinkable only weeks ago. A major component of today's show is going to be about organizing and activism. From France to Tunisia through Egypt, we see that the old-fashioned method of taking the streets still can produce some mighty powerful effects. Many in the United States feel such a tactic is archaic. It's not for me to say whether it is or isn't, and in this regard, when it comes to strategy and tactics, I certainly defer to the expertise of some of the people we'll hear from on today's show. So first off is Eric Mann. The Labor Community Strategy Center and the Bus Riders Union are exemplary instances of the power of organizing and activism right here in Southern California, where this show is being produced. So take it away, Eric.
So I've been asked how to build a vibrant U.S. left. My name is Eric Mann. Many of you know me as the host of the 4 o'clock show that's on today, Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm honored to be part of this important dialogue about how to build a vibrant left in the U.S. I've been an organizer for the Congress of Racial Equality, Students for a Democratic Society, a shop floor organizer in GM Van Nuys plant with the UAW, and for 22 years, director of the Labor Community Strategy Center in Los Angeles. The ideas I'm expressing are my own. The first obligation and strategic opportunity is to build an international united front to weaken the power of the U.S. empire. With its voracious appetite to swallow the land, ideas, crops, natural resources, and self-governance of people all over the world, the only chance for a new left in the U.S. is to begin an alliance with 21st century socialism as it's being built in Venezuela and Bolivia and Cuba and the movements for ecological, indigenous justice in the third world. People all over the world are asking, what are we going to do about the United States? And we need people inside the United States to side with the poor and oppressed all over the world, usually in direct conflict with our own government. A new left in the United States will be multiracial and multilingual, but it can't be majority white in its leadership. That leadership must come from the multinational working class, primarily black and Latino, and the black and Latino communities who are both oppressed and have a long history of struggle and leadership. People of all races should get jobs in public schools, factories, large hospitals, and clinics to surround themselves with large numbers of workers, sometimes in unions that need reform, other times in unions that need organizing. But we have to focus on what we call demand development, because if there's going to be a new U.S. left, we have to agree on certain things, such as the environmental issue. We have to support the Cochabamba Accords for the Kyoto Treaty that talk about reducing greenhouse gases by 50% by 1920, by 2020. Let's say that again. Cochabamba Protocol that talks about reducing greenhouse gases by 50% by the year 2020. We need to free the vast majority of the 2.3 million people in U.S. prisons and the 70,000 prisoners in California alone. The prisons are themselves cruel and unusual punishment. And the vast majority in prison are there because of poor representation and being black and brown. 1 million of the prisoners are black, 500,000 1,000 are Latino. The war on drugs and the war on crime have done nothing but lock up the urban poor. Proposition 19, to legalize marijuana for personal use, was a challenge to the broader theme of the criminalization of a medical problem and opened up a battle against the entire war on drugs, and I hope we put it back on the ballot soon. We have to open the U.S. borders and provide amnesty and citizenship, if they so choose, for the 14 million immigrants presently being hunted down by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. We need jobs or income now for the 32 million people who are unemployed or just outside the labor market altogether. We need a social welfare state, not a police state, an environmental justice state, not the warfare state. That would mean 1,000 more buses, 1,000 less police, the closing of the 800-plus U.S. military bases around the world, cutting the U.S. military budget of $1 trillion, including the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, cutting it by 75% for a start, which would free up $750 billion for schools, hospital parks, and a bus-centered public transportation system. We have to stop the traffic of women and girls, especially the atrocities around U.S. military bases. And we have to live and let live and allow self-determination to come to be by keeping U.S. hands off Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and other nations around the world who are seeking independence and self-determination. There are many more critical demands, many of which are outlined in my forthcoming book, Playbook for Progressives, 16 Qualities of the Successful Organizer. But after we've agreed on a program, what do we do? The first thing is, if you're not in an organization, join one. The left is weak because too many people, especially on the white middle-class left, are solely avid readers and listeners to left critique, or at best email activists. While all those modalities are great, the Tea Party is in the street, while the many who consider themselves left are in front of their computers. We need more people to see the essential role of grassroots organizations that, unlike the Democratic Party leadership, are willing to stand up to the right. It's important for Black, Latino, Asian Pacific Islander, and indigenous peoples, especially women, to join their people by joining multiracial organizations that are overwhelmingly people of color, or their own racially defined communities as part of a broad progressive united front. Women's leadership is coming to the fore in organizations all over the world. We need more women's leadership in organizations that welcome it and promote it already. The trade unions are a tricky terrain. Many of the unions are focusing as adjuncts to their own employers. Some unions suppress internal reform movements, but the union is still the largest organization of working people. If you're in a union, become more active, build a left caucus, and bring the programmatic demands above into your workplaces. If you're in a non-union workplace, help to organize a union, organizing drive among your coworkers. And again, as you're talking to them about the union, say, we have to get out of Iraq. We have to get out of Afghanistan. We're not out of Iraq. There are 50,000 troops in Iraq. It's called an occupation rather than an invasion. That is to say, you have to be constantly organizing new people. You have to support a movement of movements. We need groups coming together around a clear, counter-hegemonic program that challenges the ideology of the United States ruling class. At this point in history, I don't think we need or could construct a left party in the U.S., but we need a lot more discipline and connection, a lot more comprehensive politics, and a lot less one-issue-at-a-time politics. We need volunteers to contribute at least 8 hours of time to a grassroots organization, and for activists to become organizers. This just scratches the surface of the conversation, but let me end with a couple of concrete actions. First of all, to double our contribution to KPFK. Where else could, and this is not a fund drive, where else could this discussion take place? What would we do in the age of Fox News and Comcast buying up MSNBC, and the first thing it does is fire Keith Olbermann on their first day of ownership? Where else can we have a discussion about the closing down of all 800 U.S. military bases or cutting 75% of the U.S. military budget? We need people's institutions as a foundation for a new left. A vibrant, well-funded KPFK is part of the solution. In terms of elections, we are between a rock and a hard place. The Democratic Party under President Obama is now leading the occupation of Iraq and the invasion of Afghanistan, while supporting the corporate rich. On the other hand, the Obama administration has supported women's right to choose, appointed Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, not radicals, but moderates to liberals as a counterweight to the Scalia Supreme Court. He's constructed a strong environmental protection agency, and he has excellent civil rights people in every department of government. And that EPA is fighting corporate polluters despite the opposition of big business, despite all Republicans and many conservative Democrats. There's a strong argument to be made to support Barack Obama in 2012 in the fight with the frenzied fascist Tea Party. I hope every listener can understand the differences between the center-right politics of Obama and the counter-revolutionary politics of the armed right. Many listeners support the idea of a third party, and former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney ran a fine campaign against Obama on the green ticket, but had virtually no funding. There was a press whiteout of her campaign. If that is your choice, sign up and do it well, including contributing a lot of money. But let's understand that the main danger right now is a neo-fascist right that is trying to dismantle government that regulates corporation and create big government for military, dismantle government that's going to be for civil rights, and increase government for police. So they're not for small government. They're for large government for subsidies to the rich, large government for the military-industrial complex, large government for the police. So we have to understand, don't listen to their tricks about they're for small, limited government. They are, in fact, for a racist police state, and we better get out in the streets and stop it. In either case, presidential electoral politics will not set you free. We need grassroots movements on the ground in black and Latino communities. We need to work with immigrants, focus on the working class and working class women of color, and an internationalist, anti-imperialist strategy. We need to stop watching the movie and start becoming actors in history. So what does it take to be an actor in history? I'll give you two examples. One is to come to my own organization, www.thestrategycenter.org or www.busriders.org. And there are many other great organizations throughout the country that you can join. But I want to talk about something we should all be doing right now. The FBI has been crashing into the homes of movement activists who were in solidarity with the people in Palestine and Colombia. They've brought them in front of a grand jury after 20 FBI agents kicked in their door based on two things. One is this Supreme Court decision called Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, which says that anyone who even advocates for a country that the United States declares as terrorist is subject to arrest. So what we want to do is there's an organization called Stop FBI Repression, and its website is stopfbi.net. You're going to write to Eric Holder in Washington, 202-353-1555. Because, you see, we want to tell him to stop arresting people, free the people that have been arrested, stop the indictments and the subpoenas. Because if we're saying that you want to make history, we can't let the government arrest the people that are making history. This is Eric Mann, the co-host of Voices from the Frontlines, wishing you a good day, and thank you so much for listening to my ideas.
This is Alan Minsky. The show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. I'm speaking with Isabel Garcia. She is a lawyer in Tucson who has worked for immigrant rights for years. She is with Coalición Derechos Humanos, the Coalition for Human Rights in Tucson. So, Isabel Garcia, you work in one of the frontline struggles for social justice in the United States. You are advocating on behalf of a community of workers who are under intense, virulent pressure from the far right. What is your perspective on what a vital, powerful left in the United States would look like, and then how that left would serve the communities that you represent?
Thank you so much for inviting me. Boy, that's a big question of what it would look like. I guess we would have to begin with how would we build a left. And I think what's critical for building a left in this country is to really go back to grassroots consciousness building, political analysis, and political education of the public, especially of those sectors that we would normally think of the left, that is labor, environmental, African-American issues, social justice, peace groups, anti-war groups, if those segments began to look at our political situation in a more holistic way, not in our silos, not in our limited struggles, I think we could build a left that really touches the nerve of the majority of the public that needs answers for the economic and other crises that we're feeling. And rather than just allowing the right to give them the answers as to why we are suffering, in other words, handing them on a platter that it's the, quote, illegal alien, if we were to answer those questions for ourselves and then be able to answer them to the American public, really exposing to the potential left, to the progressives in this country, how we and they have allowed the use of the undocumented immigrant in order to build up this massive military policing in prison industrial complex that is robbing us of our ability to provide any real security in the country, whether it's jobs, whether it's infrastructure, education, health services. Those resources are being diverted in an unprecedented fashion to the border, with many in the left in this country or progressives not understanding clearly that the wars abroad are so connected to the wars domestically, that we are utilizing the immigrant in all of these years in order to be able to perfect the bringing home the war. That is all of the anti-immigrant legislation that has resulted since 1994 is meant for all of us, blonde and blue-eyed, you may be, and these policies are going to haunt every single one of us because of the left's failure to really look at the issue of immigration and understand that migrant rights are human rights, migrant rights are represent the really rights across the board.
I want to ask you, how much of an absence of a void, how much is there because there's no powerful left for the very work that you do, and how much will the human rights issues that you advocate on behalf every day be assisted if there were to be even just the development, the beginning embryonic development of a powerful left in the United States?
I think the building of a powerful left is really critical, necessary, essential to the achievement of any human rights agenda for immigrants. And ironically, it's fighting for those young immigrant youth that really will save the rest of the left, save us in the field of education and in labor and environmental rights. It is only by connecting with the immigrant youth, I believe, that we can build that, and it is essential. Without building a broad-based campaign for broad social, political, cultural, human rights, the immigrant community will continue to suffer. Of that, there is absolutely no question. Look at the situation we're facing not only in Arizona, but all across the country, in terms of not understanding any of the history of immigration in this country, not understanding the specific role with Mexico, not understanding our foreign policy implications and how they cause mass migration, not accepting and acknowledging the massive contributions that immigrants have made, we cannot go forward. There's absolutely no way we can go forward in this country without the American public really becoming aware of those issues, because it is that ignorance together with the fear and a bit of a wallop of arrogance that we have a human rights crisis, so much that we take death for granted here at the border. It is now allegedly just a collateral consequence of our policies that we started in 1994, at which time people did not die in the desert. And beginning in 1994, it is part and parcel of migration from Mexico, and it's been normalized as just simply a collateral consequence of our policies.
And let me finally ask the reverse of the previous question. were there a developing powerful left, the communities that you work with, the migrant workers in South Arizona, do you sense that they would gravitate rapidly towards that political movement?
You mean immigrants?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. I think if we were to analyze what sectors are pushing for a much broader vision of justice beyond their own little interests, it is the immigrant. It is the immigrant youth who I believe could build a powerful left if the rest of us decide to join in unity with those young people. It's very clear that is why the DREAM Act has not been, it's been dangled over these students for 10 years, and again, it's not been adopted because the powerful interests in this group are very afraid of that particular segment of people, that is the young youth, immigrant youth that have come out as undocumented, unafraid, that are global in nature, that understand our connection as a world and very concretely understand what institutional violence is, living separations of their families, deportations of their brothers and sisters, not being able to visit their loved ones when they're dying in Mexico, the massive violation of just basic family rights has turned this young segment into probably the most potent political force that we have seen in a very long time in our country.
Isabel Garcia from the Coalition for Human Rights, working out of Tucson, Arizona, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
This is Alan Minsky. The series is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. I'm joined now by Francis Fox Piven, who is the Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Sociology at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And Francis Fox Piven is one of the leading researchers and activists around issues of the unemployed and welfare rights in the United States and has been for many decades. Welcome to Building a Powerful Left in the United States, Francis Fox Piven.
Glad to talk to you, Alan.
Right now, as we're speaking, the people of Egypt are rising up against three-decade-long dictatorship. Same thing happened in Tunisia. These are severe autocracies, and yet the spark that led to the uprising was the fallout from the global economic crisis. Clearly, what mobilized this uprising in Tunisia and then in Egypt, well, Egypt followed from the people rising up in Tunisia, but in both cases, at the heart of this is poverty and unemployment. In the United States, we have rising unemployment, increasing poverty, and we see no active mobilization from the poor and unemployed in the United States. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't think that people rise up just because their situation is terrible. I mean, think of the masses of people in Egypt and Tunisia. Their situation has been terrible for a long time, and not only under Mubarak, but on rulers before Mubarak. People have to have more than just grievances, more than just pain and suffering to rise up. They also have to have the hope that their suffering can be overcome, can be remedied, that their situation can be reconstructed, and they have to be able to see a way in which they themselves can contribute to that transformation. So a movement from below and a movement from the left, needs much more than a list of grievances and a list of crimes committed by the regime. It has to also have a pathway, an imaginary, about how we, here in the streets, in the factory, can actually affect that transformation, perhaps by linking arms with others.
You have spent a lifetime looking at the poor and the under and unemployed in the United States of America. I do think it is recognized among industrialized countries that the poor in the United States have not formed a powerful voice in contemporary American politics or recent American politics relative to other countries. So what do you attribute that to? And given that, moving on to the point you just made in the second half of our dialogue, what do you think would attract the large body of exploitable labor in the United States, the poor, to become more politically active?
Well, I think that what is needed is first, and this is what you and I and your listeners can contribute to. First is a sense that the blame for poverty, the blame for unemployment, the blame for suffering, the blame for school failure is not, it should not be placed on the poor themselves, because the causes of poverty, the causes for social disorganization are firmly rooted in the larger political economy. Now, our talk helps influence the way poor people think about their situation, and the way they think about the situation has something to do with how they act on it. It has a lot to do with how they act on it. After all, if people think that they have lost their job because they're no good, they're going to shrink from public view. They're going to think up excuses for why they've lost their job. They're going to hope the neighbors don't know. But if they think they've lost their job because the employer in town has been a thief, a robber baron, if they think that the banks have cooperated with that robber baron, and if they think that there are other people out there who also are on the verge of recognizing that, then they're going to, their shame is more likely, much more likely, to be transmuted into anger. And that, in turn, also depends on their ability to see an effective role for themselves in the movement against the robber baron and the banks in the transformation that might ensue. They have to see that they can become politically effective too. And that's a kind of different problem, different. Both of these are, in a sense, problems in consciousness, ideological problems, but they have something to do with the real circumstances of people. One of the problems with the contemporary unemployed is that the sites in which they can act effectively are not clear. The sort of local handles for action and the local targets for action are not clear. And that is at least in part due to the fact that the places where the unemployed congregate, like unemployment offices or offices that provide food stamps or TANF payments, that these government offices have, over the last half century, learned how to make sure that people, crowds do not gather in their offices.
Well, sticking on that point for a second, what do you think, what kind of social dialogue and vision do you think could be shared and generated among the underemployed, unemployed, and poor in the United States to motivate them to feel empowered in their circumstances and try to rectify the great economic injustice they experience?
Well, maybe movements that emerge first among other constituencies who reach out to the unemployed and the poor. What about students, for example? I mean, students are hard hit now as a result of big increases in tuitions and in fees. Students have incurred big debts, and they have to pay those back to the thieving banks. But if students who, in a certain way, have an easier time organizing because they're brought together by the university, they have local targets for their organizing, for their protests. If students were to reach out and embrace the issues of poor people and unemployed people in the United States, I think it would make a difference for the morale and the sense of effectiveness of the poor and the unemployed.
Looking now at strict policy, in a sense, what would you right now argue for, maybe immediately, even before a broader term vision or longer term vision, for policy to address the current situation that you then would feel that people who are directly affected, the poorest in our society, could embrace and mobilize around?
Well, we need to restore the safety net. It is true that under the prodding of the Obama administration, that unemployment insurance has been extended in some instances to 99 weeks, but it should be extended to cover all of those who are in long-term unemployment, and we should also make sure that programs like Medicaid and food stamps are accessible to the unemployed, and that welfare benefits, TANF, is accessible to the unemployed. Now, this is going to be tough because the Medicaid programs in each state is facing cutbacks because of the state fiscal crises. And with the Democrats in Washington and the Obama administration bowing to the austerity talk of the right, it's going to be hard to make sure that those programs are fully funded, and not only fully funded, that they have administrative procedures which make them accessible to people in need.
And finally, one of the ideas that's being bandied about throughout this series is the idea of reviving, but not even on a temporary basis, on a permanent basis, something like the Roosevelt-era's CCC, full government employment projects. These do exist in other countries. They're rare across the world, but they do. They do tend to be popular, of course, with the poorest segment in society. Your life's work has focused on welfare rights and the unemployed. What's your general thought about these kind of programs and whether it is something that should be central to a revitalized left program?
Well, I think that they should be important to a revitalized left program. But I also think that we have to expand the traditional concept of a WPA or a CCC to make sure that it includes work, the kind of work that women do, the kind of work that women do in providing caring services to people in the community. We want to build bridges, that's fine, but we don't just want to build bridges. We want to take care of children, for example. We want to provide tutoring services, daycare, and a wide variety of family services. They are important in a contemporary society, and those programs would employ women in large numbers.
Frances Fox Piven is the Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Sociology at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Alan Minsky. The show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. I'm joined now by Patricia Torres. She is a PhD graduate student in urban planning at UCLA. And she also does work as an activist with two collectives, Todos Somos, a collective that is supportive of immigrant workers in Arizona. And also she works with Insight, Women of Color Against Violence. Patricia Torres has been active in the student movement that's been vital on University of California campuses and across California since tuition hikes and budget cuts were called for following the financial crisis of 2007-2008. Patricia Torres, welcome to the show.
Hi, Alan. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, right off the bat, I want to ask you about the big question in this series, which is your vision for a powerful left in the United States, the ideas that you believe would be central, the central ideas to animate such a movement, and then how those ideas at the core of a movement could develop into a powerful movement in this country.
Yeah, that is a big question, but a really exciting one. And as somebody who is living this and experimenting with this, both in the classroom and on the streets, I really appreciate it. And I think speaking as an urban planner, as a Chicana who thinks about colonization daily, one of the fundamental principles that I organize around, and a lot of folks, whether they're students or workers, we organize around how to change our relationships to each other and to land. And this is a really important question in a context of capitalism or in a context of standing up for immigrant rights or native rights, because for a lot of us who are thinking about our relationships to land, we're understanding that the nation state has been a product of colonization and of capital accumulation. So I think one of the fundamental organizing, I guess, problems or challenges that a lot of folks I know are trying to understand is how do we change our relationship to how we treat each other so that it's not based on commodities or it's not based on competing for a job market in a system that dehumanizes us, but also how do we change relationships to land? So how do we support folks who are perhaps native to the United States and currently experiencing the realities of colonization while we're asking for expanded rights from that same nation state? So I don't have the answer to that, but that has been a question and a problem and an inspiring point of dialogue for people that I'm organizing with, whether it's on campus, whether it's in Todos Somos Arizona, where we're talking about expanded immigrant rights, whether it's with Insight, where we're talking about sexualized violence as a tool of land occupation that's been happening since the nation state formed here in the United States. So that has been a really key organizing principle. And I think another one out of that has been around intersectionality. And so as a feminist organizer, I often find myself, not so much anymore, but especially in the early days, constantly being told that issues of sexual violence or issues of healing from gendered violence were not important enough, and that we had to look at class, that we had to look at race. And what's been really beautiful that's been coming out of workers, especially workers who are female or female-identified from around the world, and also out of scholarship, is that we can't look at social struggles and movement from only one perspective. And so that has been a major, again, as you said, an animator of how people are starting to re-practice what it looks like to struggle every day. So we're not only coming from a classes or, you know, a analysis of class, or we're not only coming from an analysis of race, but we're saying, how is it, for instance, for me, as a woman who is a Chicana, who is a daughter of undocumented immigrants, who has experienced sexual violence, who is working on issues of immigrant rights, how do I bring all of those together? And I think what's really important is that I'm able to articulate that in the movement today and talk with folks who identify as, let's say, anarchists, who, you know, really have a very strong class analysis, or someone who might have a much more sort of only a racial analysis. And we're able to create spaces where we're able to sort of argue it out and talk about it. And I think what's come out is that it's very frustrating, because a lot of us want there to be like one movement that just happens one day and there's a revolution. But what I think as I get older and I'm starting to learn is that this movement is a daily struggle.
I have a few questions off of that, and it's very,
okay.
Oh, no, it's very fertile, because this does raise a very important question, which does have to do with the language of academia even, because
yeah.
when even colonization, but certainly intersectionality, you don't hear it on any of the cable channels. I mean, maybe like, you know, once every 3 months on C-SPAN Book TV, somebody will use language like that. But my experience when I was a fellow traveler with graduate students in the years I was out of college was that actually, if not that language, the very ideas you put forward were not alienating to people in the general population. In a sense, they got it. Is that your experience?
Right. Just to give an example, I fully agree. And most of my time, you know, I've spent the last almost 10 years working with youth up in the Bay Area and in different communities outside of the academy. Or even just recently, last year, when I was arrested for a large civil disobedience that we did in downtown L.A., where we shut down the federal detention center. While we were in jail, we had some of the most amazing, intellectually rigorous conversations and dialogue with other women that were in that jail. And you know, we all went, I mean, not all of us, but a lot of us went through a process where by the end of it, we're like, how do we keep in touch after this? Like, these are the conversations that capitalism does not want us to be having. You know, that a lot of times someone might say, an academic and someone who never went past third grade can't be having that kind of conversation. And that's just not true. Because like you said, this is what people experience. And so as long as there's an opportunity or a space for us to be able to be next to each other and actually hear each other's stories, and it's not done in a context where we're trying to prove the other person wrong, that's where some of the most fertile and exciting conversations have come out of. And that's how, for instance, we get new folks who come to Insight meetings, you know, or come to organizing meetings, is through relating like that.
Let me ask this then, in all of the various activist work you do, from the student organizing, the organizing for human rights in Arizona, and the organizing against violence against women, women of color in particular, is your sense, and this is throwing out to what did spark this series at this moment, which is the lack of response from a classical left to the general economic crisis, even being inspired by something as, you know, in the moment as the fact that the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy were approved by, before the Republicans took control of the House of Representatives, by the Democratic mm-hmm. Party. So where is the left? All of the communities you work with, is your sense that there would be across the board support for, sort of classical strategies of economic justice, so full-on living wage, full employment, et cetera?
How? Okay, my sense would be that overall, and I'm not, I don't know exactly what the full articulation of what classic economic justice would look like, but in terms of things like a full living wage, full health care benefits provided by the state, or at least somehow incrementally worked in through a state and private collaboration. In terms of the traditional sort of claims for economic justice, I would say that, yes, that is something that people would demand and articulate, full living wage. I would say that there's a different consciousness now happening, so it's not, I tend to frame it as sort of not like a simply a Marxist analysis or simply a, I feel like there's a strong analysis of neoliberal economics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will be at a worker's, you know, a friend's birthday party who's an immigrant rights worker, or I'll be at an organizing event, and people are talking about how neoliberal policies are affecting us here in the United States, how the rollback of social programs are hurting us all, but how those are also being felt throughout the world, and how at the same time that all of this is happening, more and more money is being pumped into militarization of our daily lives and of different spots on the globe. So I feel like people would be making these claims, but doing it with a consciousness of capitalism and the current moment of neoliberalization that I'm not sure what it used to be like because I wasn't around. But I feel like across from the classroom to the streets, people are talking about that.
And finally, you started out by talking about land and uses of land.
Yeah.
How resonant is not just a kind of general sense of the ecological crisis, global ecological crisis, but of even radical environmentalism in the communities that you work with?
Can you say a little more what you mean by radical environmentalism?
That industrial capitalism is, as it's been configured for the past century to century and a half, right up through the present, will destroy the earth and make it uninhabitable, and that the very organization of the society has to be seriously reworked if we're not going to face that, and some kind of more sustainable economic activity needs to take place.
Right. I feel that in the work that I do on a grassroots level, we're very conscious about that. And I'll just give a quick example. Before I move into that example, there's also more broad, I guess, policy level changes, things like the green economy, and a lot of folks doing work like the Ella Baker Center or Green for All, who are trying to link an analysis of ecological disaster with a race analysis of how, or a class analysis. So they're really doing great work around linking people, for instance, who've been incarcerated to funding for skills training in green jobs. So there's a lot of sort of national policy level work and other things that are also international that's happening. On the level that I work, which is a bit more grassroots, for instance, with Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, we're launching a 3-year project that is centered around self-defense. And so, for instance, Insight sees the main purveyor of violence in our lives and in our communities being through the state, so through things like the prison industrial complex. So on one hand, our workshop is very much about how to defend your bodies, how to create alternative communities of accountability so that if we are experiencing something like domestic violence in our community, we won't have to turn to the prison industrial complex, something that further dehumanizes folks in our community and ourselves. But a really big part of that project is re-understanding our relationship to ourselves and our land. The whole second piece of that is things like reconnecting to our cultural legacies of food. So learning about our own connections to food, starting sort of guerrilla gardening and urban gardening projects where we see creating our own food, food sustainability, food justice as a part of our self-defense. Does that make sense?
It sure does.
And really we're trying to do sort of the analytical work and the practical work of figuring out what life-affirming geographies look like. And it looks like creating food that makes sense to us. It looks like trying to think about how we can work with different organizations around the world who are doing sort of fair trade, ecologically healthy, sustainable work. We don't have the answer, but that's just sort of where we're starting. So again, I feel like there's a beautiful consciousness around that, and it takes a lot of work every day.
And lastly, since you're dealing with such a broad array of communities, a final question, which is from the graduate departments of urban planning at UCLA through to the people who are crossing the desert in Arizona, you really do sense, though, that the ideas in many respects that you're describing, these ideas for a better society, for a more humane way of living together, are shared?
I think they're shared. I think that what's beautiful is they're distinct. People have, you know, various opinions about them.
Right.
But a general faith and a general commitment that other worlds can be possible right now is in practice across all of these communities. And that doesn't mean that it's not a struggle. And so a big part of this for me has been rethinking it in terms of a movement to struggles. And sometimes we'll have beautiful explosions or, you know, beautiful revolutionary things. That's like what's happening in Cairo right now. But there's also a revolution happening every day on the streets of East Oakland with people's street. You know, they're also doing urban gardening projects. There's revolutions happening on folks who are working on the border, simply just placing care packages out for people who are crossing. So again, they're like not the huge Cairo revolution, but they are still small acts of consciousness.
Patricia Torres, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Patricia Torres is a graduate PhD graduate student in urban planning at UCLA. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Alan. Take care.
This is Alan Minsky. The series is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. And I'm joined now by Derek Jensen, who's one of the leading radical voices talking about the environment and the ecology in the United States. He is the author of many exceptional books, including Endgame, The Culture of Make-Believe, and The Language Older Than Words. Welcome to the series, Derek.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The reason I want to speak to you is because this series is about building a powerful left. And when you look at left configurations around the world, sometimes a radical critique of the environment is present, sometimes it isn't. My sense is, not only for myself, but I think for so many people who will be listening to this series, any left movement that doesn't include an absolutely radical, to the root, understanding of the crisis we're in facing the environment is really a false left. So I want to get your thoughts on that and how a radical critique of an environment could fit into a newly revitalized left in the United States.
That's a great question, and I have sort of two different directions to go with that. One of them is that I'm not really convinced that there's much of a left in the United States, and I'm grateful to Gail Dines, the anti-porn activist, for pointing this out, that really a left is defined as being anti-capitalist, and in the United States, there's very, very little anti-capitalist left. So, you know, basically the United States has essentially two right wings, with one of them on a scale of 1 to 10 being about a 1, and the other one, or no, let's make it a 2, and the other one being, you know, the Republicans are 2s, the Democrats are 3s, and the lefties are basically at 4. And there's no strong strain of anti-capitalist critique in this country, which there needs to be. And the second direction to go, having to do with including the environment in any dissent or any response to power, is that the environment has to be included in really any discussion, because without a natural world, you have no world at all. I mean, one of the things I think is just insane is if you take so many of the solutions proposed to, so-called solutions that are proposed to global warming, what they all do is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And that is literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because what they don't understand is without a real world, you don't have a social system, any social system at all. Any social system is based upon having a real physical world. One more thing real quickly. I was doing an interview a few years ago. It was just wretched. It was with this right-wing, anti-environmental, property rights uberalist, Bible thumper, who wanted to yell at an environmentalist, evidently, but I didn't know that going in. And I was talking about how the oceans are getting murdered and salmon are getting hammered and global warming, docks, and mother's breast milk. He kept saying the same thing to me, which is, Derek, that's all really interesting, but let's get back in the real world. And that's how a lot of people use that phrase. The real world means sort of real politic as opposed to the real world. And we have to remember that the real world is the real world, and it's the basis of all life.
Well, the funny thing is, in hearing you say that, is I actually thinking, trying to bring a left, and again, part of the inspiration for the series, as it were, is what you just said, that there is actually no meaningful left in the United States. And, you know, we see that even in something that would seem to be at the root of what a left would be responsive to, which is a strong response to the economic crisis. But in terms of reality and getting back to reality, I think if a left cannot incorporate a radical critique of the environmental crisis, then it's not going to really become powerful in this country, because my sense is that there is actually a groundswell of people across the society who recognize that the earth is in serious crisis, that human society, as it certainly as it's currently structured, is unsustainable. From your perspective, involved in the environmental movement as you are, isn't that your sense, that this is actually, it is a burgeoning movement?
Oh, absolutely. And part of the role of the sort of ecological intelligentsia is to co-opt that back into safe directions. There's tremendous understanding that the world is just being hammered. I mean, you look outside, every year there are, you know, fewer migratory songbirds than there were the year before. Where I live, 5 years ago, you couldn't hold a conversation at night outside because the frogs were so loud, and now the frogs are gone. And this is happening everywhere, and people see it. People hear it. People feel it. And then one of the functions, you know, this is sort of Chomsky 101, one of the functions of the corporate media is to continue to misdirect so that people think that small, non-systemic personal changes will somehow equal social change, when what's necessary is organized political resistance. And I'm not trying to do a plug for KPFK, but this is one of the absolutely central things that KPFK and stations like it does is, God, it sounds like a fun drive, is they provide this other voice that you will not hear on the corporate media. And the reason you don't hear it is because it's corporate media. And that's part of the problem with the entire environmental movement, is people understand this in their bones, that things are very, very wrong, and then they get handed these solutions that are facile or just wrong. And that's very, very discouraging to understand something's wrong and then be presented with false solutions. And they will be false solutions so long as they don't take capitalism, and indeed civilization, which is a larger picture, but for now we'll just talk about industrial capitalism, as long as they don't take industrial capitalism into account.
Well, when you go back to powerful labor movements throughout the last century or 150 years since the Industrial Revolution, they promote industrial capitalism often. And this would then seem to be something from your perspective, and certainly a perspective that I share, that has to be shifted out of. How do you see, and again, you obviously think about the state of the environmental movement a lot, what would in Western Europe and Canada be called a red-green alliance, what in the United States would be called blue-green alliance, an alliance between the sort of economic left and the environmental movement, given that many of the strategies for empowerment on that labor-based left can't really be viable given the environmental crisis?
Well, that's another great question, and we've seen this a lot in the anti-deforestation campaigns here in the Northwest, that there would be an entire co-optation, even though, for example, a great example of the spotted owl debate back 20 years ago is that constantly loggers were getting very, very upset that their jobs were being lost to protect the spotted owl. But what the real truth was, which rarely came out, is that more jobs were lost to raw log exports and to automation than to habitat protection, far more. And in fact, all through the 80s, when the cut was going up, jobs were going down. But once again, back to the corporate media repeating this all the time, that's never the way the debate was framed. And one of the things that ends up happening, it's really problematical because the entire economic system is extractive, and you can't, an extractive economy cannot be sustainable. But that doesn't alter the fact that right now, you know, person A needs a job because person A has two children and those children are going to starve. And this is one of the corners that this wretched culture has painted us into, is where people are dependent upon jobs that are destructive, and they recognize they're destructive, and that doesn't alter the fact that they have this primary emergency of paying rent. And that's any good abusive system, whether we're talking about an individual, personal, domestic violence abuser, or a larger social construct, one of the first and most important things they have to do is to make the victims dependent upon the abuser. And one of the ways I put this is that one of the reasons we don't defend the land far more than we do otherwise is because we are, if your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from the tap, you're going to defend to the death the system that brings those to you, even if it's a destructive, oppressive, exploitative system. If, on the other hand, your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, people used to drink from rivers. They were not polluted. Imagine that. And if that happens, then you will defend to the death the land base and the river. But the system has systematically interposed itself in between us and the source of life. And that's one reason that a lot of people can come to believe that industrial capitalism is the real world. But the first thing we have to do is to recognize the system for what it is, and then we can start making more honest decisions about what we're going to do. And so far as alliances, it's really hard, because if we can cut through the propaganda, we can recognize, at least in some senses, we do have a sort of hardcore environmentalist, and a hardcore union person would have an alliance in terms of attempting to stop the large corporations. And then at some point they'll have differences. I want to tell you a story. I know that we're running out of time, but this is, I love this story, and it gets to the heart of this. Years ago, I was living in northeastern Washington, and I was up collecting firewood from slash piles in the national forest. And my truck got a flat tire, and I looked at the spare, and the spare was flat. I hadn't checked it in years. So I'm not going to walk. I'm way out there. So I go thumping down the road about 2 miles an hour, and I come to this guy's house. I stop and ask him if he's got a pump, and he doesn't, but he has a spare. He gives me a spare. I go home, change the tire out, go back the next day, take him a cake and to thank him. And he invites me to his house. We share a piece of cake, and then he says, "Do you want some firewood? I got plenty out back." I said, "Sure." So we go out there. He's standing there holding a chainsaw. It's very clear from his house that he's a logger. And as he's standing there holding the chainsaw, he says, "Well, what do you do?" And I, oh, man, it's like, I'm a writer. And he says, "What do you write?" I'm thinking, I don't know, science fiction, fantasy, or something, but I'm not a very good liar. And so I say, well, and at the time I was writing a book about how the big four timber companies got their land illegally from the public domain in the Northwest. And I say this, and he starts swearing. He turns red in the face. I'm looking for a break in the fence. And suddenly I realize that he's an independent logger who's been put out of business by Weyerhaeuser. I'm sorry, by Plum Creek. And he hates the company worse than I do, which I didn't think was possible. And he knows more about the company than I do. And, you know, give us another 30 seconds. We got our arms around each other's shoulders swapping atrocity stories about Plum Creek Timber Company. And then we agreed. You know, it's like, yeah, we're going to work together to take down Plum Creek. And then I said, you know, I'm against all industrial logging. And after we take out Plum Creek, I'm coming after you. And then he and I both just laughed and laughed because we recognized that we have this much bigger problem, which is Plum Creek and the corporatization of corporate control of our economies. And so I say this in terms of making those alliances that, yeah, he and I were opposed in that he was not against all industrial logging. But, you know, for now, we need to take out the big corporations, and then we can resolve our other differences. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Derek Jensen, thank you for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States. And Derek Jensen is the author of many books, including the animated book As the World Burns. You've been listening to Building the Powerful Left in the United States. I want to thank our guests, Eric Mann, Isabel Garcia, Francis Fox Piven, Patricia Torres, and Derek Jensen. I want to thank our engineer, Federico Garcia, volunteers Evan Kendall and Vanessa Gonzalez, and Melissa Figueroa, who is the webmaster for buildingapowerfulleft.org. You can hear this show and previous shows from the series on kpfk.org and buildingapowerfulleft.org. And remember to tune in tomorrow again at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time here on Pacifica Radio for Building a Powerful Left in the United States.